Blog Talk Radio.
Monday, October 28th, and this is Foxology Today. I'm Silver Ray Fox, your host. Welcome to the show. And I've got another great show for you today. Yes, I do. So glad that you have taken the time out of yours to join me. I hope it's been a great day for you already. Well, I want to start by asking you a question to ponder. Pretty important. A few weeks ago, I talked about how it's possible to miss things if you aren't paying close attention. And yes, it is really true. Sometimes we can be so focused on ourselves or anything in life for that matter that we can miss some critical or important issues and opportunities. And I really do know this to be true. It's been quite a few years ago now, but there have been three instances in which women who were closely related to me who suffered silently in domestic violence. And if that's not bad enough or sad enough, I had absolutely no clue. Was I just not paying attention? How could something so seemingly obvious be missed by instinct, insight, or even by the natural eye? I don't know. I've asked myself that question many, many times. And after discovering these truths in the lives of these women, I had to look for answers just to satisfy my own heart and soul. For me, it appeared improbable that this could be happening in any of their lives. It seemed impossible that I could have missed it, but I did. I ultimately had to look for answers, and I found them by volunteering at a local women's shelter that aided women and families in this type of crisis. And it was there that I learned about the deep secrets that are kept by victims of domestic and sexual violence. It was even more heartbreaking for me to learn, but I had to know. I felt partially responsible for the ignorance that I had obviously displayed, but that's what can happen, especially if you don't know what you are looking for. Today, we will talk about the dilemmas of domestic and sexual violence and what to look for, how to get help, and what the National Center for Domestic and Sexual Violence is doing to impact many lives and communities across the nation. My special guest today is Debbie Tucker. She's the executive director of the National Center for Domestic and Sexual Violence. Even more than that, she is truly a force in establishing organizational programs and laws that support these critical issues. So happy to have you with me. Welcome, Debbie Tucker.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. I'm delighted to be with you, too. I've already grown quite fond of you just in our getting it together to be on the call today.
Well, thank you so much. I always am happy to gain another sister friend. That's what I call all of you, because we seem to get so connected on so many levels when we have so many interests in common, and I'm just glad that that's happening with so many of my connections. Thank you so much for saying that. Well, I tell you something. When I read your bio, you are one impressive and aggressive lady.
I like to think assertive as opposed to aggressive, because I've tried hard to get out there and work with people and make things happen. And, you know, sometimes I have been a tad pushy, but most of the time I have found a way to bond.
Yes, of course, and I mean aggressive in the most positive sense. Sometimes you have to sometimes you have to bulldoze to get some things done, but I know you did
right.
It like a lady.
Right.
But I want people to know a little bit about your history and some of the groundbreaking things that you have done in the area of domestic and sexual violence. So let's talk about, first of all, your beginnings in this area of help for women and families.
Well, I'd be happy to. I, like many people, and you just mentioned a while ago, volunteered to get involved in these issues. The Austin Rape Crisis Center, back in 1973, when it was being organized here, was the very first in the state of Texas. And I was a student and happened to see a little article in the Daily Texan, the University of Texas newspaper, indicating that a group of people were coming together to respond to the needs of victims of sexual assault, and if you were interested, to go to such and such at such and such and get involved. And I did. And, I graduated from UT and continued to volunteer once a week to answer the phone once we got the Rape Crisis Center stood up and going, and kept learning and learning. And the occasion came to have a staff position there and to work on it full-time during a summer. And when they called me up to ask me if I was going to come back to teach my class, I was like, no, darling, I have found where I need to be. I discovered how much I loved digging into not only helping individuals, but trying to figure out how laws, policies, practices, the ways that professionals, family, and friends were responding could make all the difference. And we began to get a bunch of calls from women who said, I wasn't raped by a stranger. I was raped by my boyfriend, or I was raped by my husband. What should I do? And we started to realize that there was this tremendous issue, not only of sexual violence, but of domestic violence, of some violence in the context of an abusive relationship where an individual was using sexual and physical violence on a partner. And we started learning and learning and learning and realizing that we had to be broader in our thinking about how to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a lot of years ago in 1973, and you've made some huge advancements, both professionally and also lawmaking. Will you tell us about some of those things?
Yes, ma'am. I was proud to host the very first meeting of all the rabble-rousing groups in Texas that were interested in figuring out the larger issues that were impacting all of us. So we had nine communities who sent representatives to that first meeting. We formed the Texas Council on Family Violence, one of the first state domestic violence coalitions in the country, and we started analyzing together what the law did and did not do that was helpful or hurtful. And we started working with all kinds of other associations, the Texas Municipal Police Association, the Texas District and County Attorneys Association, social workers, medical personnel. We found that this conduct, this use of violence in relationship or even as some of it is against someone you don't even know, there were so many people who needed to play a role and who were seeing bits and pieces of it. And as we got more organized, we started hearing from ministers, from individuals in all walks of life, really, teachers everywhere, saying, this is happening. What should I be doing? How can I help? And I want to tell you that so many people had the same experience you've had of finding out later that someone they cared about was actually being a victim of domestic violence and being intimidated or actually even harmed by a partner. That is not unusual. And it is still to this day a challenge for many victims. They're embarrassed. They're worried that we will judge them, that we will ask that ridiculous question of, what did you do to cause this to happen? Why did this person get mad at you? Not understanding that domestic violence has very little to do with the conduct of the victim and has everything to do with the attitudes and beliefs of the person using the violence. But we had to learn all this, bits and pieces, step by step, together. And we began to run around the Texas Capitol and realize that there were things that could be done there that would help us. And it's interesting thinking back, one of the people who helped to organize the shelter in McAllen, Texas, he's now a senator, and Juan Hinojosa serves in the Senate in the state of Texas and has been a tremendous advocate and ally all along in making sure that we looked at criminal law and practice, that we looked at strategies for intervening that would keep people safe and would stop the violence.
I can remember years ago, and it's been quite some time, Debbie, where if there were a domestic, quote-unquote, dispute happening in the home of a husband or wife or a boyfriend and a woman, it was not something that the police officers would even attempt to make any kind of assertive approach toward. They kind of wrote it off as, oh, that's just, what husband and wives do or girlfriends and boyfriends do. They have some spats and some fights and that's it. I can remember where it was kind of brushed over. At what point can you tell us in the history of it that laws became critical and implemented and enforced to help victims of domestic violence?
Well, I would say that too has been a slower process than we ever expected, but and really not just in Texas but all across the country. When you change the law, that's just the first step. You have got to educate the law enforcement community that the change has occurred, and you've got to work with them and prosecutors and judges and probation and parole and all kinds of people to make sure that they understand that they actually do have not only an authority but a responsibility to act differently around these kinds of cases than they did way back in the early years. And I can remember a judge who I was talking to one time said, "Oh, darling, that's not the law in this county." And, you know, you have to overcome those individuals who sometimes are resisting seeing the change. But what was wonderful in many respects with law enforcement officers is that their hearts were hurting. They were, for the most part, pretty pleased that we began to change the law and to give them more ability to intervene effectively. And they felt badly for all the times that they had walked away when women and maybe children were sitting there crying and were definitely hurt, but they didn't have the capacity to make an arrest without a judge's order. And so changing the warrantless arrest statute, giving law enforcement officers the authority to make an arrest without a judge issuing a warrant first, allowed them to observe that a crime had been committed and to record the evidence and to take somebody in right away so that the safety of the people in the home was enhanced. And they at first were a little timid for fear that they were going to get in trouble somehow, but as they got used to it, they became very pleased that they could do something that actually helped.
Let me ask you this question. With that being the case, and I'm certainly happy to hear that, I know that many attitudes had to be affected by that, because I think sometimes we do view our law enforcement teams as less empathetic, but I know that is not the case, and so that's really good news. Can you tell me, from where you sit, has it helped? Can you see the statistics that bear witness that did make a critical impact?
I can say that, you know, in the great state of Texas, there are 1,780, I believe, police agencies, local and county organizations that are responding. There are thousands upon thousands of individual law enforcement officers. And to saturate the training and the policy in such a way that each of them overcomes any bad information that they had or old practice has taken time. And, you know, you can certainly look around and hold up examples where individuals have still not acted as they are authorized and encouraged to do in the law. We went back in, I think it was 1985, and created a whole section in the Code of Criminal Procedure that speaks to the roles and responsibilities of various individuals and cites the penal code and other statutes to try to help them recognize that the expectation and the backing was there for them to do the right thing. But not every individual does the right thing in any system. And across our state and across the country, it can still be a challenge to gain the proper response from local entities. It's not a sure thing anywhere that you live. It's something you've got to look into and find out about. And hopefully the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which I'm very proud that we helped to create that service across the whole United States, and we just in the past couple of years added all the territories, so that you can call 1-800-799-SAFE from anywhere and get information about the laws and the practices and what you're likely to encounter and who you can reach out to for legal and other kinds of help anywhere in the country. And that service was a tremendous leap forward, and that was part of our passage of the Violence Against Women Act. Another hat that I wore was the founding chair of the National Network to End Domestic Violence, and working with then-Senator, now-Vice President Biden to write the original Violence Against Women Act and to get that passed so that we'd have a national framework where we could, as service and activist, work with systems more effectively. And it's made a huge difference everywhere in the country.
That is awesome. Debbie, tell us what are some of the current statistics surrounding these issues. People, and I know it's no longer just women, but people who are being affected by this issue, what are the statistics look like currently?
We see that it is one in four women are going to be struck and harmed by a partner at some point in their lives, and one in 72 men are also going to experience an incident of violence from a partner. So it is an experience that is more common for women, but we are learning that more men who don't come forward and use formal systems for help are out there and are in need of assistance. Now, some of those men are being harmed by other men that they're in a relationship with, but it is still an unfortunate problem that there are women who use violence against male partners as well. And that's not what I meant when I said we need equality. You know, I was not looking for women to take on some of the more negative power-related attributes that have been part of our society and the whole world's way of raising men. What I was looking for was for equality in education, in employment, in opportunity, and I was hoping that more men would adopt an attitude of not using violence, but instead respecting and supporting the people around them.
Can you tell me what are the age statistics as well?
You know, we have learned a lot about that, and we've had an excellent partner in the Division of Violence Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and they have worked with us so much more closely in the last 15 years to try to analyze and understand better what's happening. And we have a lot of good information on our website, which is www.ncdsv.org for National Center on Domestic and Sexual Violence.org. And that we have found that there are so many young people who experience their first attack from a dating partner at 12, 13, 14 years old, that we sort of did away with a bumper sticker that we had for a long time that said a marriage license is not a license to hit, because it really wasn't that relevant. What we had to understand was this conduct was becoming well established in people at a much younger age than we had appreciated. And yes, there are still people who come forward and say there was never any incident of violence until after they were married, and sometimes even after they were married a year or two. But that's much, much lower percentage of people. The vast majority of people we hear from, there was some kind of violence or act of intimidation much earlier in the relationship and in their lives. So It's a problem all across every age group, and the complexities of the different ages. When you're a child, really, when you're under 18, we had the problem of the law not permitting you to ask for any kind of assistance without parental consent. So in our state and in many other states, we've worked on developing a way that young people can receive crisis information and support from an organization like a local rape crisis center or local domestic violence agency without that being a violation, because they might not be ready to talk to their parents about what's going on. They may need some information and support to get ready to do that. And so to close off the opportunity for them to talk to anybody, even in a crisis situation, was a really unfortunate aspect of the law, and we were able to change that. And we are now allowed to provide assistance to somebody for 15 days before we have to seek parental consent.
That's wonderful. I want to talk now, Debbie, about situational circumstances of women, families who experience this. And while I know that it really doesn't matter how good your life is or how bad your life is, you can be a victim of these issues. But I want
right.
to talk about a couple of things. I learned quite a bit about the psychology, if you will, of victims. And I also want to discuss signs that they should look for and let them learn that these are true red flags to pay attention to in a person who has that type of aggression in their personality and in actions. But let's talk about first the women. You and I had a talk about that when we were prepping for today. We just talked a little bit about it, and I know that I told you, you asked me about the women that I had spoken about in the intro, and I did tell you, but I did not say to the audience that these women are survivors and thriving survivors at this point. And so they were able to get through it and never choose to experience it again, went on to lead productive lives without any potential for abuse to ever occur, thank goodness. However, I did also know that that statistic is not the case with everybody. A lot of people who experience abuse continue to choose relationships that they will have another offender. They'll have another abuser. And for some reason, I'll tell you what one woman told me when I asked, do you know why it is that you seek out that type of relationship, even though you've walked away from one? And her answer was mind-blowing. She said, because there's something wrong with me. She said, there's something wrong with us. And I thought, wow, you know, every time I think I've gotten a breakthrough in my thinking about what I understand about it, somebody would say something else like that, and that I'd have to ponder and probe for a greater understanding, and not just for myself, but to offer some kind of clarity to them about options and opportunities and other things in life that are better than what they have been accustomed to. So will you share some of the things that you know and recognize about that particular psychology that women experience? And when I ask that, I mean in terms of is it typically that you see a lower self-esteem? Is it typically a parental association of some sort? What kinds of things have you learned as a leader and as an organization about what are typical things we can learn about the victims?
Well, what's interesting really is that everything we've seen has shown us that the victims are all over the place. Some of them experienced abuse as children. Some of them were raised in homes where violence occurred and was committed, and they grew to see that as somewhat normal. But many had never experienced any kind of acts of violence in the people around them. And when they first encounter someone who's willing to use violence, they're shocked and they're amazed, because this person had seemed to them to be loving and caring and wanting to have a good relationship with them. And then suddenly, you know, things start to happen and the person seems to change. And folks talk about sort of, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing. Or do I have those backwards? Mr. Hyde, Dr. Jekyll? I'm not sure. But they, you know how they people sometimes just seem to totally flip around on you. And when that happens, it depends on how deep you are as to whether you have the gumption, if you will, and are prepared to up and walk away. So I've seen everything. I have seen women who have been on, you know, 3 or 6 dates with somebody, and suddenly they do something like slap them across the face or shove them, and they're out of there. And then other women who take too much responsibility for that behavior and try to tell themselves, oh, if I hadn't said this, if I hadn't done that, they wouldn't have gotten them upset. They didn't mean it. They apologized. One of the benefits for women in going to a shelter for counseling or even having to stay in a shelter for a period of time for their own safety is they get to talk to other women. And sometimes, you know, like 10 o'clock at night, they're sitting and folding laundry. All the kids are in bed. It's quiet, and they are talking. And they realize they were all married to the same guy. The conduct, no. The way that the person who uses violence has handled themselves and has intimidated them is so consistent. And so what the research shows us is that the attitudes and beliefs of the offenders is the biggest predictor. And for victims, but for the grace of God go I, anyone can have the misfortune to become involved with someone who uses violence and wants to have control over their partner so much that they're willing to use violence to get it and maintain it.
Hmm. Can you share with us some of the red flags that women can look for that will give them some clues that they may be dealing with a person that has an attacker or abusive personality?
Yes, ma'am. I think there are a number of things to look for, and that can be, as you call them, red flags that can cause you to recognize that this person may have a whole lot more going on than you really want to contend with. The easiest one is trying to limit and control who you see and strategically isolating you from friends and family. And it can be kind of subtle at first. It can be, oh, I don't much like that friend of yours, you know, Silver Ray. She's kind of, you know, she doesn't like me. I feel uncomfortable around her. Let's don't get together with her as much.
Mm.
You know, and you kind of accept it and say, well, yeah, my friend is kind of an outspoken lady, and, you know, maybe she's more than he can handle right now. And you kind of accept that, and then suddenly it's, you know, your dad looks down on me. I don't want to go there anymore on Sundays for dinner. I don't like hanging out with your brother. More and more and more little ways in which you back off from the relationships that have provided you support to that point. So isolating you is a very consistent strategy that offenders use. Another consistent strategy that is actually described by many as more harmful than even getting hit, which provides a lot of clarity. When somebody hits you, then you really can begin to tell where they're coming from. But insidious statements that criticize you, you're too fat, you're too skinny, your hair looks frizzy and frazzled, your makeup is too much, too little, you know, that was stupid, what you just said. You're stupid. Those kinds of things hurt to the core and erode people's confidence so much that they, and when I say insidious, it's intermittent. It's not every day. It's every few days, and it's strategic to kind of break you down and to harm your spirit so that you begin to think less of yourself. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is seeing people come out of this. I have seen women, children, men who have been subject to abuse, just having a few days of being around people who treat them with respect, they're stunned. They remember who they were before all of this started happening. And they realize that they were under a cloud and that they were undermined as spirits and people. I always think of this one lady at the shelter who served this phenomenal meal. And everybody was raving about what a good cook she was and how fabulous everything was. And she burst into tears and sobbed and said, I haven't had a compliment about my cooking in probably 5 years. I've had, you know, mashed potatoes tumped over my head and rubbed in my face. I've had the food thrown on the floor and called slop. And for y'all to say it's good, it's just so wonderful.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So that lady, within 3 or 4 weeks, was in a whole different place.
Wow. That is so amazing. Well, I heard a couple of things in what you said. Sometimes the behaviors may not seemingly be obvious that that's where it's leading to, and that's something to pay attention to, because what I learned is that these women will isolate themselves, and that's part of the reason you don't recognize they're undergoing the abuse, because when it happens and they have the physical signs of it, they won't answer their phones, they won't make themselves visible, sometimes for weeks, and so, you know, that part of it, I can see where that strategy would be there. And then there are, like you said, the obvious things of criticizing and put downs and of course, the hitting. I want to share a short story of something that happened to me many years ago. I was a lot younger, and I had a friend who was like a brother to me, and so we had chats like girls have chats. We would have chats often, and I was liking this guy, and, of course, you know, my play brother, I'm telling him all about it, and I was telling him things that he had said to me and things that he wanted me to do and, you know, seemingly advice that he was giving me about things. And then my friend, who was like the brother, said to me, wait a minute, because he knew my personality. I've always been, you know, pretty outgoing, pretty assertive. So he said, let me ask you something. He said, there's just some things that you just told me about him that I have some concerns about. And only a man could have brought this to me, that, you know, this to my attention at the time. But I'm so glad that he had that kind of love and care and concern and eager for what I was saying, because he said, I need you to ask that guy something. He said, you need to ask him, would he ever hit you? I said, what? I started laughing.
Wow.
You know? He said, no. He said, no. He said, I am dead serious. He said, at an opportune time, I want you to ask him, would he ever hit you?
Mm-hmm.
And so I trusted this guy so much. I knew he had a real good heart for me. So one night when we were out, I just kind of casually said, I got a question I want to ask you. I said, would you ever hit me? He paused. Like he was thinking and kind of scratching his head, and he said, I don't think so. I said, uh-oh, wrong answer. My friend
right.
told me if he says anything but no, I would never do that. You got to drop him like a hot potato. And that's
mm-hmm.
exactly what I did. If he said anything
mm-hmm.
other than no, he could never, ever, that would never happen, then that's the wrong answer. And
right.
so I, you know, I say that to any woman who can use that as a probe if necessary, and certainly enough that hopefully you'll get the truth as I did. And but there are ways, of course, that you can ask questions, and it doesn't have to be that question, but you can ask other questions that will definitely reveal to you maybe an underlying flaw in the character of someone who will potentially harm you at some point. And I know that I learned in many cases, like you said a little earlier, Debbie, once they're in it, they become so ashamed and afraid and controlled. At that point, it's often difficult. And I've heard of stories of women who stayed in those situations 20-plus years. Without.
Yes, ma'am, that is still possible. And the other thing that is very encouraging, though, is how many people who are being hurt quickly say, up with this, I will not put. And they
mm-hmm.
are learning more and more. We're doing so much more in the schools, in the churches, in families to actually talk openly about the fact that this kind of violence can and does occur, and that people use it in relationships to control. And the more educated people are, the more likely they're able to see it. And, you know, I have this vision that, you know, at some point in the future, the schmucks who do this are just going to die off, because there's not going to be anybody who will go out with them and marry them and have children with them and raise another generation of young people to think that using violence is okay. We can get rid of this. We can stop it. And I have seen individuals who use violence stop. There are many battering intervention programs now in a lot of communities, and the vast majority of people who come to those are referred by family and friends, and maybe even their boss or their minister tells them, you have absolutely got to go to this. You have got to stop doing this. If you don't, you're going to lose your family. You're going to lose your freedom. You know, maybe a third of them are sent by the courts in response to them being arrested and having committed an act of violence that is, you know, prosecutable, that they could go to jail for. And instead, in many communities, they're offered an option to go into a battering intervention and prevention program and unlearn and relearn how to be with people.
Right, right. I know that that is true. In the training that I've had regarding this, I did mention to you, too, there is a batterer's anonymous or something with a term similar to that. And I actually got to speak with, several men who were in the program. And I think it's a very positive thing if they would understand that somebody does understand that you can have issues deep enough and lack the understanding to know what to do about it yourself, and that there is this platform where they can go and get help. And I don't think anybody, you know, it needs to be ashamed. You need to do it if you know you're going to potentially continue to harm someone or perhaps cause someone to lose their life. It's better to save both of you by going ahead and going into an intervention that will change your life and change your perspective, change how you think. Because a lot of times, and I you can speak to this, Debbie, I'm sure a lot of people just haven't been loved right growing up, and if at all, loved at all. And there are things that can really make you grow up very angry, hateful, and lacking a real clear understanding of what to do with yourself and your life. And so you take it out on other individuals. So,
I have a quick story. I got to thank Danny Glover a couple of days ago for his portrayal of Sir in The Color Purple. You remember that incredible movie?
Of course.
And his portrayal of a person who was using violence in his relationship, but they showed how his father ran him down constantly, berated him, made him feel bad about himself, and how all of that was interconnected. And he had to pull away from everybody, including his father, and just sit with himself for a while and rebuild and begin to do things in relationship with other people that was right. Didn't you think Danny Glover did a great job in that movie?
Yes, I did. I did. You felt like he had redeemed himself by the time the movie was over.
Right. And
yes,
it showed
absolutely.
that many of these offenders do have some degree of pain from their own prior histories. Now, that doesn't excuse them. That doesn't mean that we accept their use of violence against others. It means that we've got to help them peel it back and to understand that because they feel bad, they can't make other people feel bad as a solution.
Correct, correct. Well, let's talk about also the wonderful programs that are available for the women and families that do find themselves at a point where they have to find other opportunities to go on with life without the husband or the partner that they have spent too much time, unfortunately, at the hands of abuse. Would you get us up to speed on some of the programs and opportunities that your organization is offering for folks across the country? I know we have the hotlines. We can mention those
right,
again.
Right. The hotline is an important first link, and that's 1-800-799-SAFE. And SAFE stands for 7233. And so the hotline is 24/7. And it is an access point if you're not able to identify in your own community which agency is providing assistance to victims of domestic violence. But many times, and particularly in larger communities, folks know that, like here in Austin, it's Safe Place. In Houston, it's the Houston Area Women's Center and several other agencies in Houston, AVDA, Aid to Victims of Domestic Abuse. There are several there that offer important services. And so for victims, what they need many times first is safety. They need a place to go, and they need to be able to just pause for a minute and know that they can sleep and that they can have a couple of days where they're not under constant duress. And then they can start to get information and to think about next steps for themselves and for their family. Sometimes it's so bad and that the offender is so unwilling to take responsibility for their conduct and unwilling to make changes that the victim just has to figure out how to move on. And if they're married, then they're going to have to figure out how to get a divorce. Maybe they need an order of protection to be able to go back to work and feel safe at their job. Maybe they need temporary and then later ongoing child support from that offender to be able to make it economically. If they don't have a job and they have need to develop the skills and the capacity to do that, shelters also provide access to job training, assistance in finding a job, and so forth. It's very practical and also very warm and caring. And there's opportunity to let things go and unload emotionally, and there's also an expectation and support provided to lift up and move forward. And people are different. I mean, but the average length of stay in a domestic violence shelter is about 12 days. The majority of people come, figure out next steps, put things in place, and move.
That's incredible. I was just about to ask if you offer transitional programs where if they had to stay over, can they get additional support? Do you help them with housing?
Absolutely.
And things like that?
And we learned that, too, that you know, depending on the circumstances of the individual and, you know, what kinds of education or job skills that they have and how many children they have. I mean, we've had women who've come into the shelter, you know, with a couple of three children that are under school age or they're about to have another baby. And, you know, they need time. They're not in a place where they can rush right out and go to work, but they need a capacity to make it for a while until those children are a little bit older and can go to school and so forth. So, you know, all of those kinds of things have to be taken into account. And the main thing that I think is critical about the philosophy of battered women's shelters is that women are not square pegs to be shoved into the round hole of a program, but instead we are to meld ourselves in such a way that we support the individual, and we help them figure out what they think is best and how to get them what they need to implement that.
Before we wrap up our conversation today, Debbie, we did not talk as much about the sexual violence. I'd like for you to just say a few things about that and point women who are experiencing that as a form of violence, because you mentioned two circumstances that I didn't actually consider when we began the conversation. You're talking about people who are in a relationship with their husband or their boyfriend, and we often think of a rape crisis as, again, somebody you didn't know and an uncalculated time and anticipated situation, all of that. But speak to that for a few minutes and give out the information for those and an encouragement as well to reach out to you.
Yes, ma'am. I think that one of the things that I'm glad that we have on our website under the resources tab is a links to hotlines, and we have an entire page that describes the various hotlines that are available, and there is also a national hotline for sexual assault. It's called RAIN, Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And that number is 1-800-656-HOPE, which is 4673. So that's 1-800-656-HOPE. And that organization likewise connects individuals to the nearest local rape crisis center agency. And sometimes those are co-located with battered women's shelters. They're under one organization. Sometimes they're separate in a community and work together but are not the same agency. Almost all of us are 24/7, so that you can call at any time and connect with somebody locally who can provide specific information about what's available to help there. You know, we didn't know this when we first started, that the vast majority of sexual assault was occurring in the context of some kind of relationship, dating or more. We thought it was the stranger jumping out in the raincoat, you know, as you're walking down the street. That still happens, but it is the smallest amount of the problem. People are more often raped in their own home by someone they know or someone they have met at some point along the way, not a complete stranger. And so, you know, there's nothing that has been shown to be more challenging to the spirit than to experience a sexual assault. It is such a violation physically and emotionally and spiritually that it is important to reach out and get help and to be able to talk about what you went through. And similar to victims of other crimes, being able to hold that offender accountable and stop them can be very healing. I worked on a case here in Austin where 17 women identified the same man as being the person who broke into their home and raped them. And those 17 women formed an incredible bond as we went through the process of identifying him, getting him arrested, and getting him prosecuted and sent away. And they helped to take care of each other. But again, that was a stranger case. It is harder to come forward and talk about the fact that the person who raped you was your boyfriend or was your husband. It seems more difficult to admit that that's where it's coming from. But it's very harmful, and it is an aspect of the counseling that victims need to feel comfortable in telling people at the Rape Crisis Center or the shelter to get it up and out, because that's when the healing begins.
Would you give out your website addresses again and those phone numbers and any
yes,
other
ma'am.
Information
our
you'd like
website,
to tie this up with?
Yeah, our website is based on our name, so National Center on Domestic and Sexual Violence is www.ncdsv.org. And that website gives connection to almost everything that's out there, including the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 1-800-799-SAFE, and the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which is 1-800-656-HOPE. All of those resources are standing by.
Great. Debbie, I want to thank you so much for being my special guest today and sharing so much education, information, and insight regarding this topic. I found it very important, and I know that this is also Recognition Month for this as well, so I wanted to make sure I shed some light
on
it. Thank
goodness,
you so
we
much.
We didn't even say that, National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Thank you.
Yes. And I just want to just congratulate you all for the incredible and outstanding job that you're doing and that you personally have done over the great many years in your organization to keep this movement going and keep providing more and more help and resources to these victims. It certainly is commendable and admirable. And again, I thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Ms. Fox.
Forward.
I enjoyed it very much.
Well, you are welcome. And I'll look forward to touching base with you. And next time I'm in Austin, reaching out so we can get together for lunch.
Sounds great.
All righty. Well, you enjoy the rest of your day. I'll touch base with you again soon.
Thank you. You too.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I want to thank all of you, too, listeners, for tuning in today. I have had Debbie Tucker, Executive Director for the National Center on Domestic and Sexual Violence. We've talked about many areas of concern for those of you who may be impacted by that issue. Again, the numbers to reach out are 800-799-SAFE for domestic violence, 800-799-SAFE. And if you have encountered sexual abuse or violence, that number is 800-656-HOPE, 800-656-HOPE. The website is ncdsv.org. Please, if you or anyone else you know needs help, reach out using this information. I want to thank you for listening. I do have another Foxology special coming up this week. I'll be talking with Karen Campbell of The Rose. That's an organization here in Houston that supports women in breast cancer screenings, diagnosis, and treatment, regardless of their ability to pay. And I'm definitely looking forward to talking with them and sharing that information with you as well. In the meantime, I hope you have a great day. I'll look forward to you tuning in and talking to you next time. Thanks so much.